From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. You just heard Hastings Street, which was performed and composed by drummer and 2023 NEA Jazz Master Lewis Hayes. Born in 1937, Lewis Hayes remains quite simply one of the great jazz drummers. With a sense of timing without rival, Hayes is able to move easily from high-flying solo turns to being one of the best accompanists out there with his formidable rhythmic sensibility. He may be one of the originators of hard bop, but no one matches his quiet sensitivity on ballads. He's played in bands led by legends like Cannonball Adderley, Oscar Peterson, Horace Silver, and McCoy Tyner. In the early 70s, Hayes co-led bands with Junior Cook and Woody Shaw before leading his own bands that included talent like Kenny Barron, Dexter Gordon, and Freddie Hubbard, while featuring new generations of stellar musicians. If you listen to jazz at all, you have heard Lewis Hayes. He was a sought-after sideman and has recorded on hundreds of sessions with artists like John Coltrane, Cedar Walton, J.J. Johnson, and Joe Henderson. I had the opportunity to speak with Lewis after he had been named a 2023 NEA Jazz Master. And I asked the Detroit native to tell me a bit about the song we heard at the top of the podcast, Hastings Street.
I wanted to do a tribute to Detroit, and I thought about this street they call Hastings Street. In the 30s and the 40s, that was a very special street for people of color.
Now, you come from a musical city, and you grew up in a very musical household. Both your parents played instruments.
Exactly right. My mother played piano, and she sang quite a bit at home and in the church. And my father played piano and drums. And also, I had a cousin whose name was Clarence Stamps, and he played drums. And that was my teacher, my number one teacher.
First, what kind of music did your dad play?
Jazz also. In the home, I heard recordings of Mr. Ellington, quite a bit, big bands, I would say, and all kinds of music. I mean, it was rhythm and blues. I loved everything that was good that I heard, and it affected me a certain way. But I would say in my early teens, I heard this art form they call bebop, and I heard Charlie Parker and the rest of the musicians that basically played that art form. That really got my attention. And musically, I went in that direction, and I'm still trying to get it together.
I wonder if you can remember, Lewis, or even thinking back now, what it was about that, about Charlie Parker, about bebop, that just grabbed your interest so much.
Well, I think it's his sound, the music that he chose to play, his facilities that he had. This music is a very complicated art form. And you have to be able to perform and have the knowledge to play on a very high level. And he could do that. He played his saxophone. It was so much clarity. And he had so much knowledge of what he was doing. He was like a laser if he played so well. It takes a lot of practice to do things. Whatever you choose to do it on a very complicated high level, it takes a lot of being by yourself, I should say. And working things out in your own mind. And he had really done that, and that really got me a place where I really went for that art form.
And what drew you to drums?
Well, piano was first, but I didn't fall in love with the piano. I fell in love with the drums. I think one of the main reasons was the drums were something that I knew I could do. It came easy for me. And I saw other kids playing the drums that were older than me, having a lot of problems. And I would watch them, and this was very easy for me to do. I could outplay them without even thinking about it too much, really. So naturally, I went in that direction, and I liked the instrument, I really did. And my father gave me his drum set, and then luckily, I had a relative, Clarence Stamps, who was a drummer also, and he had a lot of knowledge about the instrument. He taught me my rudiments and how to read music and a lot of things that was very necessary to know about the instrument that a lot of people, young kids my age, did not know. I got a lot of knowledge from him at a young age.
Detroit was such a rich place to be a musician, and especially a young musician. And very, very early in your career, you were a kid. You played with Yusuf Lateef. How did that happen? How did that come to be?
I played with my friends at a very young age, street dances in each other's basements at home. And I had been on the road, different places. My mother let me go. But Yusuf came at a time when I was, I would say, 18 years old. And the, like you said, the quality of the musicians, the art, the way they could play this art form was on a very high level. People like Kenny Burrell, the guitarist, and Barry Harris, the pianist, Tommy Flanagan, the pianist, Paul Chambers, bass. I mean, there's so many great artists in Detroit when I was coming up. I was appearing in a nightclub, Klein Show Bar, with an organist. And when that job was over with, Yusuf was bringing his group in next. The club owner, whose name was Mr. Klein's, said to Yusuf, "You have the job, but I would like for you to have Louis Sedale Hayes play the drums." So he came over to the family home, asked my mother if it was okay. And he said to me, "I'm going to give you a 6-week trial." And that was just magnificent, 6-week trial. And I do not remember how long that I had an opportunity to be with Yusuf in the Clyde Show Bar. But it was a nice period of time. And it was very enjoyable. But a lot of things happened to me before that time. I mean, I started having a band about at 15. A lot of things happened before Yusuf, but Yusuf, that was a major opportunity for me at that age in Detroit. That helped me get myself together for one night. They had an after-hour place called the West End, and the bassist, Doug Watkins, who was appearing with the Jazz Messengers, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, and the trumpet player from Detroit, Dollar Bird. So that night, we had the opportunity to come together as young people and as musicians. And so when they got back to New York, the Jazz Messengers was disbanding. And Art Blakey was keeping the name Jazz Messengers. And Horace Silver, the pianist, was starting his own band. So Doug Watkins and Dollar Bird, they said to Horace Silver to get me from Detroit to be in the group. So Horace Silver called me in August of 1956, and that was the biggest, that fixed me right up. My dreams were coming true. And so I came to New York to join Horace Silver at that time. And appearing with Horace Silver was just magnificent. He wrote so much music, and we got along on such a high level. So that's how it started my career in this place that I always wanted to be in, New York.
You know, what strikes me is that you begin at the top. I'm not saying it was smooth sailing all along, but just stayed there, moving horizontally and accruing different experiences with different musicians, because you were 18 when you started working with Horace Silver.
Actually, 19.
19, I'm sorry. Still quite young.
Yes.
Tell me, how did you learn Horace Silver's music?
Oh, that's a very interesting question there, because it was difficult. But Horace, we had this relationship immediately, this feeling together. Horace would invite me over to his apartment and play the piano and play compositions of his on the piano. It was no music being written, anything like that. He would let me just listen to his compositions and use my own imagination to do what I wanted to do to accompany and to make music with him. So that's how I basically learned his music. And the first recording date that we did on Blue Note was entitled Six Pieces of Silver. I came in August, and I'm pretty sure we did that in November of 56.
It's a classic album.
You said it, got it right. Yeah, it was a magnificent album, classic album. And I had the opportunity to play, to record, I should say, five albums with Horace Silver on Blue Note. But during that time, I had the opportunity to meet so many magnificent musicians who are here in New York and record with them also. People like John Coltrane, it was quite a few.
I was going to ask you about the New York jazz scene then, because it's in the 50s, and what a place for music at that point in New York.
Yes, we were moving musically in a certain direction, and we were some guys that I was around were still very young. It was a lot of magnificent places to play, nightclubs and places to play to hang out. Places stayed open until 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was my first time being away from home and being able to be free and just be my own person. Oh, that was a major thing.
I just want to talk for a second about Horace Silver, because while his melodies were beautiful, he had a really complicated rhythmic patterns as well. And that playing was almost percussive. And I wonder how that influenced you, inspired you.
Horace gave me the opportunity to grow. I was pretty good when I came here, but I wasn't consistent. I learned to be consistent in playing this art form, because you have to be able to be consistent every night. I basically sometimes would play pretty well, but sometimes my ability to play would go down some. And everyone basically coming here when you're a young person, this is the Mecca, New York, and you grow here. And it took me at least about 2 years, I can recall, that I could really feel that I was changing and my ability to play was changing. I was coming into my own, but it took about 2 years for that.
You had to have been like a sponge in some way, just listening to everything and absorbing all this music. But you are also developing your own signature too, your own sound. And you just explained a bit, you know, how it takes time, but you were able to do that. And it was, I'm going to assume, playing on such a high level all the time and being challenged.
And another thing that happened to me here, which was a big thing, Joe Jones, the drummer who came to New York with Count Basie, he was my mentor. He didn't like too many people, it seems like, but he liked me. So I had the opportunity to be around him a lot in my younger life. And a lot of times, it wasn't actually about music. It was about how to be a man, a young man, and how to live this life and last. Take care of yourself. So I learned a lot. I was very, very fortunate. I learned a lot of that from Joe Jones.
You played in a lot of sessions, as you mentioned. You played with John Coltrane. You played with so many people. And I'm curious about how you hooked up with Coltrane. Were you called in for that session? Were you playing with him at the time?
I think what happened was we all were a major big family, musicians that lived in a certain area and was recording, and we knew each other. If it wasn't personally, we knew each other musically. And he was doing things, and he just wanted me to be able to record with him at this one particular time. I had the opportunity to do three recording dates with John Coltrane.
Didn't you do Lush Life?
You're right on it. That's what it was called. I wouldn't have never thought about it, but you said it.
Yeah.
You got it right.
Could you just tell me how it works? I mean, would you rehearse? Would you just show up and play? How does it work?
The record company usually it pays for a rehearsal, at least one. So you do rehearse at least one time, and then you go into the studio, and things that you're not really comfortable with, you work it out there. And so that's the way it basically happens. The art form takes place just like that.
So you're working with other musicians while you're with Horace, and after 3 years with Horace Silver, you move on. And let's talk about that move, because that was really important, too.
You're right. Well, I was appearing on a Monday night. There was an off night of Birdland, session night. And appearing that night was Hank Mobley, tenor saxophone, trumpet was Booker Little, Bobby Timmons, piano, Sam Jones, bass, and myself. And when the job was over that night, Sam Jones came to Bobby Timmons and myself and said to us, Cannonball, who was appearing with Miles Davis at the time, said he was leaving Miles and starting up his own band, and where I consider coming with Cannon. And at that time, I was having a magnificent time with Horace Silver and everyone in the band. So that was, like you said, that was a major decision. And after going back and forth between the two of them, I decided to go with Cannonball. You said I had been with Horace for 3 years, and I went with Cannonball. And I stayed with Cannonball from 59 to 65, 6 years. And that decision that I made was the right decision. It was a family band. I mean, it was Cannonball and his brother Nat and Sam and myself. We were a real family. And Horace Silver and myself, we still stayed close friends through it all. But I went with Cannonball, and we made so much history that it was really a magnificent period of time in my life.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about that history that you made, because this was what critics call hard bop was being developed and created, and you are one of the people doing that with Cannonball. And you're defining this, and I wonder how you would describe the kind of music you were playing with Cannonball.
Well, it would be hard for me to describe it, because actually what we were doing, we just was playing what we felt like playing. And we didn't have any name for it. We just was doing playing what we felt, and it felt good. And Cannonball was a fantastic person to be with, and we got to know each other very well, our families. And Cannonball had the kind of band where we not only traveled together, we partied together. If someone had something important happening in their lives, and whether it was good or bad, it was something that we worked it out together, if at all possible. That was the most amazing band that I've ever been with that had that closeness to it that I could ever experience. That was a very unique situation with Cannonball and his brother Nat, Sam Jones and myself. actually, the people, the musicians called Sam Jones and myself the dynamic duo, because they like the feeling Sam and myself had as a rhythm section together. So we had the opportunity to not only make records with Cannonball, but with other artists also.
You and Sam were with Oscar Peterson.
Exactly right. When it got to the point after that 6 years, we had been around, you know, Oscar Peterson and the trio, Ray Brown and Ed Thigpen, on several occasions. Actually, for me, I didn't have any idea that I was going with Oscar Peterson. It was arranged, I would say. I mean, I never went to Oscar Peterson and we had any conversation about me joining the Oscar Peterson trio. All I can recall is one day, Cannonball says something about going with Oscar Peterson. He says, I cannot pay you the kind of money Oscar can pay you. And it went like that. And the next day, I was dealing with Oscar Peterson. And Sam came along. First was Ray Brown was still there for a period of time, which was magnificent. Magnificent person, Ray Brown, musically and as a person, as a man. And then Sam came. So I was there with Oscar Peterson for at least that time, I don't know, it was over two or three years, something. And then I was gone, and I was doing my things with my compadres like Freddie Hubbard and Joe Henderson and Kenny Barron and a lot of people. And then it was something like 70 or 71, Oscar got in touch with me and asked me to come back again. So I had this magnificent opportunity to be with Oscar Peterson Trio two times.
Well, Louis, let me ask you what the difference is for you playing, for example, with a quintet or a sextet and then moving to a trio. I imagine it's a different relationship musically.
Yes, it is. And Oscar Peterson being Oscar Peterson, I mean, on the highest level of his art form, is a challenge, and it is different. I was not on my own just doing whatever I felt like I wanted to do. With the other groups with the horns, I was basically playing what I felt like playing. I was going in the direction that I wanted to go in. With Oscar, it was not completely like that. I was playing myself, but no, I had to follow the leader, Oscar Peterson, and listen to him closely and pay close attention in the direction he was going in, very close attention. And in a trio, it's harder to play because there's less people. You can't make mistakes because they stand out on like real good in a trio. So you have to get the arrangements together, and it's very important to play the arrangements right because, like I said, it's only three of you. So anything you do wrong is going to stand out, especially with a trio like with Oscar Peterson, who plays the piano, we all know, on the highest level almost you could ever get. You really have to have it together and be on top of your art form at all times, because he was.
Meanwhile, I'm jumping back a bit, because you had already released your first album as a leader, called Louis Hayes, and I think you did that when you were with Cannonball, because you had a lot of his quintet. They were your backup. What did you want to do when you started stepping forward as a leader? What did you want to do with the music that you felt like you couldn't do playing as a sideman with other people?
Well, actually, I wasn't interested in being a leader. Not at all. It was a DJ from Chicago, Sid McCoy, and he was affiliated with VJ Records. And he said to me, like you said, when I was with Cannonball, Louis, we'd like to record you as a leader. We were appearing at that time, when that happened, at the Apollo Theater. We played there all day. And Cannonball gave me his whole band. That's the kind of person Cannon was. And they put the music together and they asked me, who would you like to play saxophone? And since I was had done some things with Yusuf before, I said, Yusuf, Brother Yusuf. And they got Brother Yusuf, and that's the way it happened. And after I did that first recording, I still was not interested in being a band leader, not at all. I was only about 22 then or something. But I didn't get interested in being a band leader. Out of necessity, that happened. After I had made so much history and recordings with other major artists, and after being with Oscar Peterson and so many people, I had to come become a band leader. There was no other place for me to go. The only thing was for one period of time, I was with McCoy Tyner in the trio. And McCoy, we knew each other very well since he was with John Coltrane. We all friends. And actually what happened was our daughter, it was time for her to go to college, and I had a band, a quartet, but I was not making enough money, I felt. And McCoy wanted to start a trio. And we came together, and it worked out perfectly for at least over 2 years. And we were working, making money, so my daughter could go to college. It worked out. He got me out of that situation. And then I could go back to being a leader again.
How did you work to keep your stamina up so you could keep on doing this for as long as you've been doing it?
That's a very magnificent question there. I would say, put it like this. I have been touring a lot with these other groups, but think of getting a band together again. I had a relationship with the tenor saxophonist Junior Cook, who was also, we were together with Horace Silver. I said, I want to put the band together. So I called the band the Lewis Hayes Junior Cook Quintet. And we got this magnificent trumpeter, Woody Shaw. The Lewis Hayes Junior Cook Quintet featuring Woody Shaw. Now, you spoke about traveling. And we got this person to handle her business who's here with me right now, actually, Maxine Gordon. Now, in going to Europe was very difficult at that time. Traveling, you rail passes. And like I said, it was very difficult, but we were young. So that made all the difference in the world. Being that age, traveling on trains and sometimes hotels and things that were not the best, most comfortable, and for long weeks at a time. But to be able to do that, for me, you have to be a certain age and love the art form.
Lewis, you said that you didn't want to be a leader and you became one by necessity, but I would still think that there's a sensibility that you wanted to bring to the band as a leader. And I wonder what that was for you.
I've always been a person that musically, I always wanted to do what I want to do. I'm not a musician that wanted to make everybody happy. I want to make myself happy first, always. That's the reason why I decided to play. And I wanted to make the musicians that I'm appearing with feel good next. And then naturally you want the audience to enjoy what you're doing. But I feel in order to make the audience enjoy what you're doing, you have to be happy doing it. So the musicians that I would always choose to play with and vice versa would be people that musically we got along well together, and as people we got along together well. People can see that and feel it. Everyone enjoys themselves then. So when you're having that band, Lewis Hayes, Junior Cook, Woody Shaw Quintet, and we recorded together on Muse Records, and then we did some things with Dexter Gordon, and then after that, I moved on, and I had a quartet with Frank Strozier, alto saxophone, Harold Mayburn, piano, and Stafford James bass, which was a very unique quartet. The only thing was that we traveled in Europe quite a bit when you speak about the travel. Oh, we did some traveling with that quartet. It needed someone that could handle business on a high level, and we didn't have that. So it only lasted for a period of time, and then everybody went their separate ways.
But that quartet was a powerhouse.
Oh, I'm glad you say that.
Extraordinary. Let me ask you this, because you've worked in many, many sessions, and I'd like you to tell me the difference for you when you're working as a session musician as opposed to working with a group that you're a part of, as opposed to working as a leader. There has to be shifts, I would think, among the three.
Yes. when you're working as a leader, you're involved in the music and what music that you're going to perform, and you can make yourself comfortable doing exactly what you want to do. But when sometimes when you're working, being a part of someone else's recording date, it might be some things that you're not comfortable doing. But Joe, I must say this, I've been so fortunate. I've had opportunity to make so many recording dates in my life. Magnificent people that I was recording with. But they were people, artists, that was musically coming from the same place as I was. I was not out of my pocket. I mean, you know, it was people that was thinking the same way I was. That's how we got together. So I've been pretty fortunate of being able to be a person that played this art form all my life and have done and played music that I felt like I wanted to play.
You know, as a drummer, you take fewer solos than many other musicians. And when you do, it's glorious. And I wonder if you could just share a bit about the clear joy you have in supporting and challenging other musicians who you're working with and then, you know, holding forth and taking that solo.
So I have enjoyed being a person, a supportive person, but I have established a reputation of being able to play time very well. And they would say, on top of it, my cymbal beat has been a major part playing this art form. I didn't start out like that because I wasn't planning on it, but it just happened like that. Cannonball featured me soloing. It was one composition he used to play. We used to play Bohemia After Dark. I was featured all the time with Cannon through the whole period of time that I was with Cannon for the whole 6 years. He featured me playing this composition. And then with other people like Freddie Hubbard and myself, my very close friend, the trumpet player Freddie Hubbard, we lived in the same building for years in Brooklyn. And we challenged each other. Freddie and myself, we had a band together. Musically, we enjoyed playing with each other very, very much. And Nancy, in those situations, I soloed a lot. But I was good at it. My biggest thing was accompanying my time and the feeling I have. That was what I'm really known for, more so than soloing. And I like that.
You went on to form the Cannonball Legacy Band. So tell me why you wanted to do that and what you wanted to say with that band.
Well, this friend of mine who took over the club, Sweet Basils, and they changed the name to Sweet Rhythm. So he says to me, Lewis, we would like to hear that music again that you played with Cannonball Adderley and the quintet. Everyone in the band has died but you. So he gave me the club to put a band together for a whole week. And I put together this personnel with Vincent Herring, the alto saxophonist, who had appeared with Nat Adderley, Cannonball's brother, and after Cannon passed away. So he helped me put it together. But that was at least 19, 20 years ago. I mean, and we don't do this all the time, but on occasion, we do it. We had the opportunity to record 3 CDs. So over all of these years, we've made a lot of different appearances, different places in this world, with the Lewis Hayes Cannonball Adderley Quintet.
You gave us a present for your 80th birthday with Serenade for Horace, so thank you. It's a beautiful tribute album that honors Horace Silver but doesn't try to imitate him. You know, that can be a tricky needle to thread. Can you tell me how you approached that album?
What happened was Horace Silver, after being living in California for a long period of time, and he bought a home in New Rochelle, and I don't live too far from there. And like I was saying earlier, Horace and myself, we always had this strong relationship as friends. At this time, Horace was not well. His body was not well at all. So Horace liked for me to come and visit with him. So I would go to Horace's home, and we would talk. And he would say to me, "Lewis, you're part of my history." So he didn't have too much time before he was leaving and on another journey. So when he did that, Maxine Gordon, and she asked me, she said, "Lewis, what would you like to do?" And the first thing I said was, "I would like to do a tribute to Horace Silver on Blue Note Records." So she put it together and arranged it, made it all possible. So that's how it came about. And I'm very satisfied with the music that we actually put together.
Younger musicians into that project with you, and I'm wondering what you told them about Horace Silver and his music before they began to play it for the CD.
Actually, I'm truthful with this. I didn't have to tell them anything. They knew his music. We all know each other, whether they're younger. The only thing that really counts, major thing I should say that counts, is if we're compatible together. When I came to New York, I was the youngest one in the band always. This now, I know just everything changes now. I'm the oldest one all the time. But we were compatible as people, musicians, and musically. So it was no problem with that. They know the music. They know Horace Silver. They knew compositions that I wouldn't have thought of to play. So it worked out just, we were comfortable with it, and we did that, and then we moved on from there just with the same personnel. I like having a group. I came up like that, as we know, and I like having a group with the same personnel. It makes me very comfortable.
And then in 2021, you brought out another album, Crisis, with your quintet. What inspired that album?
Well, one thing, the pandemic was happening at that time. And again, Maxine and myself, we're in tune with each other. So Maxine put it together for me to make that recording. And this pandemic was happening, and everything was a crisis. Freddie Hubbard, he had passed away. So I thought of that composition of his entitled Crisis. And I said, I like the composition. And I like the title, because everything is a crisis. So that's how it started.
Have you toured at all since things opened up again?
I have played, not really on a major tour, but we have played quite a bit since then. In Boston, in Baltimore, California, and we have some more things to do. So like I said, I haven't been on any major tours, but we're into it now. Now, I'm really happy to be able to make this history and to be able to keep on going. And I would like to be able to last as long as my body. And I look good. That's very important. Look good and feel good.
Agreed.
And I continue to move on.
It's wonderful, Lewis. Thank you. And thank you for all your wonderful music.
Thank you, Joe. Pleasure meeting you like this.
That was drummer and 2023 NEA Jazz Master, Lewis Hayes. Lewis Hayes and the other jazz masters are being celebrated at a star-studded tribute concert, which will take place on Saturday, April 1st at 7:30 p.m. at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. The concert is free, but tickets are required. You can reserve them at kennedycenter.org. And if you can't make it to D.C., no worries. The concert will also be available through a live webcast and radio broadcast. Check out arts.gov for details. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd love to know your thoughts. Email us at artworkspod@arts.gov. And follow us wherever you get your podcasts, and then leave us a rating on Apple, because it helps other people who love the arts to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.